Hello and welcome to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today we tackle a very big question. Is there an ultimate theory of everything? Could it be possible that after decades of searching, it may turn out that there is no cosmic blueprint after all? That the universe is not perfectly and elegantly designed? Well, according to author Marcelo Gleiser, the universe is gloriously messy. And we're about to hear his controversial views, along with alternative views from astronomer Tamara Davis and physicist Andrew White. This forum was recorded at the Brisbane Writers' Festival last year, and your host is Dr. Paul Willis from ABC TV's Catalyst program.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cafe Scientific at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. Now, being the Writers' Festival, our main subject of discussion today is a book. It's the book Imperfect Creation by Marcelo Gleiser. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Marcelo to the stage. We like to think we live in a reasonably tidy universe. Well, you are if you're a physicist and you have equations, and the universe ought to run by equations after all if you're a physicist. But Marcelo likes to take a different spin on it. It's not the perfection of the universe, it's the imperfections that make it interesting, that make it a place that we can live in. It's a pretty big opening gambit there, Marcelo, but is that basically what you're saying? It's the imperfections of the universe that make it the place we love?
Yes. So I'm being provocative. At least I'm being honest with myself. It turns out that in science, in physics in particular, we learn to look for symmetries in everything. You know, everything that can be approximated by a symmetry makes your life so much easier. You know, you're trying to solve complicated equations, and so if you find like a symmetry, life is much easier. So you look at the sun from far away, you say, oh, it's a nice, perfect sphere. And that works for some things, but of course, if you're going closer to the sun, you realize that it isn't. So in a very basic sense, the symmetries that we look in nature, a lot of them are tools, they're approximations that we use to make sense of what's going on. And in many cases, those symmetries don't work or they just break down.
Okay, now, as I said, this is going to be a little bit controversial. So we've got some other people up here on stage today to discuss this. Ladies and gentlemen, from the University of Queensland's Astrophysics Group, Tamara Davis.
Hi there, everyone.
Also from the University of Queensland School of Mathematics and Physics, Professor Andrew White. Now, Tamara, can you help me here a minute? What does he mean when he says symmetry? Is there a fat bit somewhere in the universe that's out of line?
No, there's a whole bunch of symmetries in the universe. I mean, there's very simple ones. When we look at ourselves in a mirror, we're seeing reflection symmetry. If you rotate something, you can have rotational symmetry. But I think the real symmetries that Marcelo is talking about are actually the ones that underlie the equations and the basic building blocks of what we use to describe the physics of our universe.
Andrew, mathematicians, physicists, they like to say that mathematics is the language of the universe, of the language of science. Is that true? Does the universe really behave like it knows the numbers?
So there's something called the unreasonable effectiveness of maths, which is, to our surprise, mathematical models keep turning out to be very accurate at describing the universe. But of course, when you say mathematicians and physicists say that, really, actually, it's mathematicians and theoretical physicists. Experimental physicists don't necessarily share the same point of view. The universe is what we can measure, and then we come up with these models of it. If they match what we measure, that's great.
Now, you just said something interesting when you came onto the stage just a moment ago. You passed your copy of Marcelo's book over to him and asked him to sign it before the event, because he might not afterwards. Why?
Oh, who knows?
Let's wait and see, right?
But Marcelo, so, is it really such a radical idea that it causes fights with your colleagues, that you think that things are imperfect?
Well, let's go to the real story here. If you look at the history of science and even the history of philosophy, there has been a very, very old trend that started, say, in ancient Greece in trying to explain all that exists in terms of a unique one explanation. So, for example, the first philosopher called Thales in Greece asked what is the world made of, and he came up with an answer, and he said, everything is made of water. So, right or wrong, his notion was that you could explain the reality, everything that we look in the world, as coming from a single thing. And this sort of notion that everything springs from a single source carried on through Plato, and then later on in the Renaissance, people like Kepler also tried to find a single explanation for everything. At the time, mathematics was seen as the language of nature, as you mentioned. And so, to a certain extent, the goal of physics, or the science, it wasn't called physics then, of the natural philosopher, was to find the mathematical hidden code of nature, the beauty, the symmetry that could explain everything that exists. And this sort of notion that if you understand this mathematics of nature based on this concept of symmetry, you understand all that exists, carried on into 20th century, and it became a little more sophisticated in the sense that now you're not, as Tamara said, you're not really looking at, say, the symmetry on a cup that you can see there is a circle here. So if you turn it around and you look it from the top, it doesn't look different. So that's a symmetry. We're really talking about the symmetries that are described when particles interact, right? So everybody knows that in physics we say that everything is made of little bits, so electrons, protons, etc. And those particles, they interact according to certain symmetries, okay? And it turns out that these symmetries are related to the forces with which they interact, and there are four of them. Gravity, that we all know about, electromagnetism, that we also know about, and then you have two other forces. They're very, very short range. They only are active in the interior of the nucleus, which are called the strong and the weak nuclear force. So you have these four forces, and with these four forces and 12 little bits of matter, you can explain pretty much everything that we see. Okay? Now, four forces is way too much. So what you want is you want to, well, maybe these four forces really are one force. They are just manifestations of a single unified force. And if we find this single force, then we find the so-called theory of everything, or final theory. Okay? And the core of this idea is the notion that these four forces can be encompassed into a single force, which is beautifully symmetric. Okay? So the notion of unification, which is started with the beginning of philosophy, is very much present nowadays in theoretical physics as well. And what I say in my book is two things. First of all, I look at it from a historical perspective, and I claim that this need to say that everything is one, everything is coming from oneness, is really a religious tendency which has to do with monotheistic thinking. You know, there is one God, everything comes from God, and all the patriarchs of physics, say Kepler and Newton, were very religious. And so in their thinking, there was this notion, even when you go to Einstein, even though he wasn't thinking in terms of a Jewish Christian God, he was thinking that nature is essentially rational and that a human mind can uncover this secret hidden code of nature, and he spent 20 years looking for this unification. So nowadays, this sort of trend comes from the so-called superstring theories, okay, which is this attempt to unify everything into a single whole. And what I'm saying here is, first, where is this idea coming from? And I'm bringing this history to explain where I think it's coming from. And second, I look at the evidence that we have for that, right? And there is very, very little evidence that indeed there is a trend towards this beautiful single symmetry. What we do have in physics, and physics has advanced a lot through the notion of simplification, and there have been several steps that have simplified things tremendously. The theory of gravity that Newton developed brought the physics of what's going on here on Earth with the physics of the skies. Electromagnetism really is the bringing together of electricity and magnetism, which were thought to be two different things. And this trend continues. However, all these unifications are imperfect. They are not like perfect unification. Not even electromagnetism is a perfect unification. And so what I say is that we may stumble into more partial unifications as we go along the way, but this notion that there is this underlying holy grail at the end is to me a dream.
There's a lot to unpack there, Marcelo. Tamara, Should it all come down to one? Should there really be one unified theory? Or should we be happy with the fact that we've got four pretty good ones that describe various bits of the universe?
Well, in a way, I'd say that we already have only two, because we sort of have unified three of those. And gravity is the odd man out, if you like, that isn't fitting well in with the others, doesn't play well with its friends. But I think that there's no reason to expect that there shouldn't be some over the grand principles that we are valid in striving to find. And yeah, I think that there could definitely be something
why?
That...
But why? The way you express that, you say it almost like a religious faith that there might be something out there. Is there evidence to say that there must be?
Well, I think that the progress of physics over the last century has been amazing and dramatic, and the unification that we have seen between the forces that we previously thought were disparate is evidence to me that really there is some fundamental underlying structure, some symmetries, if you like, that are really governing the way that the world behaves.
Can I make an apart? These unifications are not really unifications, right? You're talking about electroweak. So there is one theory called electroweak, electromagnetic, and the weak interactions that I discuss. So you talk about the so-called electroweak unification. It's really a put together of the two forces. It's not truly a unification in the spirit that I'm talking about here, which is the one single overarching theory. It's like a patchwork theory.
Go for it, Andrew.
Okay, so I'm going to have to disagree a little bit. It's not a unification in the spirit that a theorist might approach it, where you want some underlying mathematical elegance to it.
Right.
But it certainly is in the spirit that an experimentalist would approach it, and then afterwards you have one theory that explains two very different phenomena, and you have an energy regime where you know, okay, they become aspects of the same thing, and now in a cooler universe they look like different things.
Right.
So I read your book, and I'm very sympathetic to all of the arguments except where you keep saying that this is somehow against the unifying spirit. And I think it's against this idea that mathematical elegance is important. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that's only ever been a disease of theoretical physicists. Speaking as an experimental physicist, we like a messy universe. It keeps us employed.
Right.
And, in fact, we like killing theories. There's no greater joy than talking to a theoretical colleague who's got some wonderful theory and then smashing it down with one little observation you've made in the lab. That's great.
So in the book, I'm very clever to say this is a beautiful theory. Electroweak theory is gorgeous, it's spectacular, it's a tremendous achievement of modern physics, no question. But you have to focus on what I'm really saying in the book, which is this really an indication that there is a single theory out there waiting for us? And I spent a long time believing that it was until I started to really think about it. And if you look at the mathematical structure of the theory, it really is not in that spirit, as would be grand unification, which is another one, which is, okay, so you have gravity, as Tamara said, which is the odd thing out for many reasons, but then you have electromagnetism, weak and strong. So the so-called gut theory, grand unified theory, would be the theory that would bring these three together, right? And this thing was proposed in 1974, and it has very, very interesting consequences. For example, one of them is that matter is unstable, like the proton would decay, okay? So if that were true, if the proton decayed very quickly, it wouldn't be here, right? So the theory says, well, you know, because we're all made of protons, essentially. The theory says, no, no, it decays very slowly. Go and look for it. So people have looked for this decay for 36 years, and they haven't found it.
What if it's a very slow decay?
Yeah, that's the problem. You see, the theory is such, has so many parameters in it, that you can always tweak it beyond the range that the poor experimentalists can go in the labs and test it. And so you start wondering, you know, what is this telling us, you know? I understand the goal towards simplification. I think that's a very important goal, and we should always strive for that. But I don't think there's this thing at the end, you know, that we should be holding on to like a religious thing.
Tamara.
I think there's a couple of different camps amongst the unifiers as well. There's the deepest unification principle or desire where people try to explain everything. What does it mean when you say theory explains something? What needs to be explained is a question that's open for debate itself. So things like the values of the constants of nature, what the speed of light is, what the charge on the electron is, these sort of things. The string theory, for example, was designed with the hope that you would actually be able to explain the values of those constants. Now, it looks like that's a futile aim. It seems that now there, even within string theory, there is almost an infinity of possible solutions. Some people found that very depressing and evidence that unification was a failure in that sense.
But it does make for some fantastic graphics on some television documentaries, doesn't it? I remember on at least one occasion seeing the multiplicity of string theories explained as a disharmonious quartet or quintet, where using the same theory, you end up with five people playing completely different pieces of music. Mm-hmm. You can't bring string theorists together, and yet string theory is supposed to bring everybody else together. What are you guys banging on about?
But they're all playing the same instruments. So they may be playing different tunes, but the instruments, the fundamental things that they're playing on are the same. And that is a form of unification in itself.
Andrew, you have young children. Maybe they're a bit too young for this question, but how would you explain string theory to them? Because if you can explain it to them, I might have some hope of grasping it myself.
Well, let's see. My oldest child's 2.5. So
that sounds about right. Yeah.
So I guess I would use Leon Lederman as a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and he wrote a wonderful book with a terrible title a few years ago called The God Particle. And at the beginning, he had a glossary for the public on the various kinds of physicists. And you should know that if you don't know any physicists at all, we really come into two camps. And he explained it as this. There are experimentalists, and these are physicists that do experiments. And there are theorists, and these are physicists that do not do experiments. And I would explain to my son that, well, string theory has come up with theorists who need to get out more. When people say we're having a theory of everything, let's just think about this. What they're really trying to do is they're fiddling around at one very extreme edge of physics. They're trying to unify all the forces. But if I take a wildly successful theory, something we've already got called quantum electrodynamics, this is the quantum theory of electromagnetism, and it's the most precise theory we have. It's been tested to something like 16 significant figures. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. We can't use it on any interesting system. We can model hydrogen with it. We can barely model helium with it. And we can't model my favourite legal molecule, caffeine. It's right on the hairy edge. And it's something like cholesterol, which would really be of interest to medical industries. We can't accurately use quantum mechanics. We have to make approximations. And I suspect a lot of the problem is we're trying to do 24th century physics with 21st century technology. And we've seen this happen before. In the 1800s, Charles Babbage tried to build what we'd now call a modern computer. But he tried doing it with cogs and steam, and you just can't build a computer that way. And it needed another 150 years of technology to get the modern computer. And that may be the problem with this kind of physics we're talking about as well. So I'm not disheartened that it's been 40 years and we've got no data. Be patient, Marcel.
Well, but I have a stronger argument against it. The way we understand the world is because we measure it, so we need tools in order to measure the world, okay? And even though our tools develop and what Babbage was doing is very different than what we can do now, and certainly, God knows, 23rd century things are going to be different as well, there is so much we can know about the world which is related to how much we can measure and understand of the world. So to claim that you have a theory of everything, a final theory, is implicitly stating that you know everything that can be known about the world. And I think that's just impossible. So the point is, you may have a theory which is a beautiful theory, very complete, and then suddenly some guy somewhere is going to make a measurement that is unexpected, that is going to throw your theory down, and you say, oops, maybe it wasn't the final, it was the quasi-final. Let me go back and look at this. So to me, it's just a silly thing to say that you have a final theory. Oh, can I tell a quick story? The God Particle, the book?
Okay, off you
so
go.
It's funny, I hope. You know. So Leon Lederman, this Nobel Prize physicist that wrote this book, and everybody gave him a real hard time about the style, the God Particle. So he said, you know, that was not my idea. I actually want to call it the goddamn particle because I couldn't find it. But my editor thought I would sell more books if I just called it the God particle.
That's Marcelo Gleiser, Professor of Natural Philosophy, Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College in the US. And you're listening to Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National, which was recorded at the 2010 Brisbane Writers' Festival. Marcelo Gleiser is author of the book Imperfect Creation, The Gloriously Messy Universe. Also on the panel, physicist Professor Andrew White and astrophysicist Dr. Tamara Davis, both from the University of Queensland. Our host is Paul Willis.
Tamara, in your notes you said that you're quite happy for a messy universe, but yeah. Do you like it as messy as what Marcelo's telling us here?
I think a messy universe is great. I think those imperfections are necessary. I'm a cosmologist, an astrophysicist. I study the universe as a whole. And we like to joke that the first thing that we assume when we do our calculations is we assume the universe is like perfectly symmetrical. It's homogeneous, it's isotropic. It makes our calculations really easy when we're calculating the evolution of the universe. Only problem is, under that assumption, which I typically make most days, I'm assuming that we don't exist. We're clearly not homogeneous and isotropic. So I actually really like the messy universe. We need the mess. But perhaps I'm a bit more optimistic that there is some more fundamental theories to go out there and discover. I do tend to agree that because we can't know everything, we can't measure everything, it's rather conceited to ever say that we've reached a theory of everything. But we can perhaps reach a theory of everything that we can possibly measure.
How can you possibly know that?
How about everything that we can measure right now?
Okay, I like that.
And because we are not at that point yet.
Okay.
So the theory of quite a lot.
The theory of quite a lot, yes.
Marcella, I just want to change tack a little bit here, because the thing that actually struck me reading your book is that there's a lot of personal material. And at first read, it seemed out of place, but then I got it. I knew why you did it. Tell everybody why it's important to understand your nightmares as a child, losing your mother, those personal things that you put into the book.
Well, because I start the argument talking about oneness and religion and faith and all that, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about myself and how I grew up. And it's true, you know, a lot of my fascination with the deep questions of existence came because when I was 6 years old, my mother died in a somewhat, well, very tragic way. And I had death knock at my door way too early, you know. And for that reason, you spend the rest of your life trying to figure out what's going on, essentially why did it happen and why to me. And so, you know, I was initially a very mystic kind of boy and very religious at some point until I started to learn history. And then history and religion don't really go together very well. So I was a little horrified by all the crimes and the crusades and the Holocaust and everything that happened. And so I decided to try to find answers somewhere else, and that was in physics and science. I realized that science actually addresses some of the very fundamental questions about existence in a rational way in which we can actually discuss and make progress, you know, and I was very happy with that sort of text. So in a sense, the reason why I go through my whole life is also to bring the reader closer to the person that is telling that story. You know, I mean, in narrative nonfiction, you want to make sure that you're taking your reader into a very long journey, so it's nice for the reader to know who the guide is, what kind of human being that person is. And I felt that by doing that, I'll be much closer to the reader and it'll be an easier read.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I picked up from it. The personal aspects of your own development and how that's influenced the science that you do. Because that's actually contrary to what most people say we should do in science. Science should be objective and we shouldn't allow our personal subjective feelings get into it. To throw to you guys, in your own scientific careers, Andrew, can you name personal influences on your own development that have influenced the way that you think about the physics and the mathematics that you do?
Well, not in the way that Marcella did, but I'm an experimentalist and we're always seen as a little bit, how can I put this? The theorists see us in the same way that, say, people who come to the library lot see rugby league players. You know, we're a little bit snub-nosed and hard-edged. So we're very prosaic. But I've had some wonderful teachers, and they've inspired me greatly.
Tamara?
Yeah, well, science is it's done by people. It's a raucous, competitive world. You make mistakes. You go out and you sort of have fun discussing new ideas with people. And you definitely bring all of your history in there when you're discussing these questions. So, you know, I liked science fiction books when I was growing up. I have no doubt that some of that influences the way that I look at things. I also did a philosophy degree. That helped as well. I had some great teachers. And when you're trying to address problems, the history that you've come through is there. You aim to be as objective as possible, but you are always looking at things through a certain filter.
Science is international. That's one of the really nice things about it. We have friends, I'm sure all three of us, all over the world. And so you bring to your science different cultural ways of addressing the same problem, which is really useful. And so, for example, one of the things I think that Australian scientists are renowned for is our really, compared to the rest of the world, quite strange sense of humour. But that really helps. You know, you can hit problems where people will sometimes despair, and you know, Australians tend to go, ah, well, We'll sort it out.
The world is so fragmented, you know, so polarized by so many issues, right? And in a scientific conference, you have people from all over the world, and they can be, you know, Hindus, Jews, whatever they are. They're going to talk about their science. They're going to exchange commentary at the same level. There is, of course, there is authority, and there are the fashion designers of science, of course. But a Nobel Prize winner or a very important science can be proven wrong by a grad student, and it happens all the time. And this is a real wonderful thing. You know, it makes this universality in science very attractive.
Because picking up from your opening statements and to turn them upside down, would we be having this discussion today if instead of a culture that's dominated by monotheism, we were a Hindu culture where there were lots of gods, and so would actually be saying, there must be one grand unified theory. No, that's the controversial opinion. How much has the social context actually influenced this debate?
Well, if my argument is right, enormously, because what I'm saying here is that this look for, this search for a final theory, a unified theory, is really a search for a kind of a God, you know, not necessarily the theological God, but this notion of the Godhead that creates everything there is, and hence we humans can be God-like by finding those answers. You know, it's to me very much a cultural context thing.
I'm going to disagree with that. I think, again, yeah, as an experimentalist, one of the reasons that we keep going with unification so far is it works. But we also know that at another level it doesn't work at all. You wouldn't use quantum mechanics to model the BP oil spill, right? It would be entirely inappropriate. We have regimes of applicability of the theory. So if you want, this is the Hindu many gods approach, right? You use classical fluid mechanics to model what's going on in the Gulf. You would never use quantum mechanics. It would be madness. So I do agree that I think that initially that impetus came out of the kind of Western. And you said it before, you said it's philosophy and then natural philosophy. And I think it's a hangover on one edge of physics. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's all of science at all.
Of course not.
And biologists really don't think like this.
I'm partnered
with a biologist. They don't think like this at all.
And you can say, you know, the theory of evolution is a unifying principle in biology, and that's perfectly fine. We have the laws of nature in physics, and they are, to me, what the unifying principles are, you know, in physics, even though it's about how universal the laws of nature are. But so there are definitely unifying principles that way. But I'm really talking about this particular search. Now, I'm not really going on, you know, shooting down the search, the attempts to make sense of chaos by simplifying theories. That, of course, is what we do.
Not the reason to do it, but Stephen Hawking is famous for saying that one thing he wanted out of the whole search for unified theory is a T-shirt. Something that you could put on as a slogan on a T-shirt. You're saying we're not going to get those T-shirts, right?
That's right, yeah.
What clothing would we get? I mean, it sounds like you're talking about a whole wardrobe.
That's right, absolutely. You know.
Well, surely it would be a G-string.
Well, I'd like to think that if there is a grand unified theory, it would be a G-string, mainly because then it would be incredibly short and I might understand it.
But, you know, I have to say, on the other hand, you could write 10 equations that would tell you almost everything that we know about what's going on. And it wouldn't be many more than that. Now, the question is, can you write one equation? And that's where things get a little extreme, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there are just a few that we use, and they're beautiful. And the solutions are the things which are hard to make sense of, and that's what we do.
And Andrew's completely right. We almost never use general relativity to describe the expansion of the universe. We use Newton's gravity because that's perfectly appropriate for the vast majority of the calculations that we need to do. And it's really difficult to calculate many of the things that we need to do if you actually use the full theory of general relativity.
Another thing that Stephen Hawking is famous for saying is that this will be about knowing the mind of God. Well, he's since modified his position because he's got a new book out, and he needs to sell that, that God doesn't need to be in the equation anymore.
No.
The sorts of physics and cosmology that you guys are talking about, is that sort of grey area in science that does seem to border into the spiritual?
There is this very old problem in philosophy and in physics too, which is it's this problem of the first cause, okay? You know, if you start thinking, why are we here today? And you have an answer for that, and you keep going asking, but why this? There's a whole chain of events that if you keep following them through, you're going to end up with the Big Bang, you know, the beginning of everything, right? So, of course, when people talk about the universe expanding, the universe having 13.7 billion years of age, you say, okay, but then how did it start? What was that first cause? And this is really the question which is at the crux of this science, religion, mind of God problem, we don't need God. That's what Hawking now is doing to market his new book. It's basically to say that, wow, you know what, you use quantum mechanics and general relativity and you can come up with a model where you don't need a first cause, right? Well, he actually said that 20 years ago already, and in the 70s, people were saying that before him. So it's really not his thing. But the notion here is that, well, does that really solve the first cause problem? I would say that it does not. What it does is that it provides a mathematical model, which, by the way, is extremely speculative right now. Quantum cosmology is way out in the fringes, okay, which is what we use to do this, to come up with a solution which is highly simplified of a very complicated equation. So these jumps, I think they're just not, should not be being done, especially by a guy like Hawking that has tremendous fame and is so important. You know, to me, that's actually a disservice because it's giving people the false notion that we scientists actually think these things, and we mostly do not.
They are beautifully unconstrained by data, these very speculative
Absolutely.
Cosmology
beautiful
models.
Unconstrained by data.
Tamara.
I'm frequently asked as a cosmologist what happened before the Big Bang, what was there before the Big Bang and what started the whole thing. And the honest answer is that we don't know. And with the link between spirituality and science, one thing I'm astonished by is that creationists don't actually grasp hold of the fact that the Big Bang theory says that there was a beginning as evidence for the fact that there's a God who started it all off. You mentioned before that religion and history are difficult to mix. I think that's far more true than religion and physics.
So I've talked to creationists about this, and this is sometimes disparagingly referred to as the God of gaps approach. Mm. So they complain that, of course, every time science explains something, you leave a little less wiggle room for your deity of choice to operate in. And so they see that as being, of course, a fatal argument. Mm-hmm. So they're not real happy with that approach to things.
Right. And to me, you know, the question of science and spirituality, there are many, many other ways of finding spirituality in nature which are perfectly consistent with science. So if you look at your hand, you have atoms in your hand that came from different stars that exploded over 5 billion years ago. To me, that's a much more beautiful and spiritual vision of life and existence than to try to, you know, squeeze God out of the picture like that. So there are ways of engaging with nature through science and by what science is saying of who we are and where we come from that, to me, are deeply spiritual. And we actually don't need any sort of metaphysical or supernatural vehicle, if you want, to find this connection with the world where it's right here in front of you, and we are actually opening these doors by trying to understand how nature works.
But Marcelo, is that spirituality or just a sense of wonder?
Well, what's the difference?
Well, I don't know what spirituality is, but I do know what a sense of wonder is, right?
I think they're very similar.
I mean, it's precisely this sense of wonder with the world that makes us go and try to figure things out. There's nothing wrong with calling it spirituality. It doesn't mean that you believe in a supernatural spirit. It just means that you have this way of dealing with emotions, you know, about what your understanding of the world.
Marcelo Gleiser, author of Imperfect Creation, The Gloriously Messy Universe. You're with ABC Radio National. I'm Lynn Malcolm with our Big Ideas Summer of Science series. We're discussing whether there really is an elegant blueprint of the universe. The other panellists are Tamara Davis and Andrew White from the University of Queensland. Now, back to Paul Willis, who's taking questions from the audience.
I was interested from Marcelo's view of the world. So it seems like a lot of physics has advanced by basically assuming the world's unified and simple, and wherever things were messy and ununified, going there and looking for a unified and simple solution. If you don't assume that the world is unified and simple, how do you guide your search for where to do physics?
Well, I would actually say that most physics is not being guided by the search for unification in that sense. They're really guided by trying to figure out what's going on in experiments and in data that you're measuring. And I have here a very good example, two very good examples of that, you know, in the sense that if you look at the physics of, say, quantum mechanics, okay, which is so important for us nowadays, I mean, pretty much all the gadgets that we deal with are related to quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, there you go. That's a beautiful example of that.
So for people listening at home, this is an iPhone.
So how did that come about? Well, experiments were being made to understand properties of matter at different ways. You know, like when you electrify a piece of metal, if you shine light to that, what happens to it? And when you heat up a body, you know, and it starts radiating energy, how does that work? So these were questions that people were measuring. They had no answers to. They tried to use classical physics, you know, electromagnetism, classical mechanics. It didn't work. They figured out they needed a completely new way of thinking about the world in order to figure that out. And there comes quantum mechanics. The point is, not every notion out there is really going for unification. But yes, it is a point. And I'm not at all shooting down the search for unification. I'm very careful in the book not to make a fool of myself in that sense, because it is clear that that is very important. What I'm saying is that all these unifications are partial unifications, you know. And yes, you make them and you're going to make some more in the future. What I'm going against is this notion that there is the final big theory out there waiting for us to be discovered. That's
another question from the floor.
The expansion of space, so following the Big Bang as the space is still expanding now, is the expansion more three-dimensional or two-dimensional? And also, does it expand at a uniform rate in all directions? And if it's not uniform in all directions, what explains differential expansion?
Tamara, this is for you because you wrote the article for Scientific American.
I think it's actually one of your students after some brownie points.
Space expands. It's not expanding at a constant rate. We thought for ages that the expansion itself was actually slowing down, because we know that if you throw a ball in the air, it gets attracted back to Earth. If you throw galaxies apart, they should be attracted and come back together. But measurements in the last decade have indicated that it's actually speeding up, which is completely bizarre. So the expansion is there and it's speeding up, and the cause of that acceleration is currently unknown. It's one of the great mysteries, and I spend most of my days trying to figure out the answer to that question. But in addition to this overall expansion, it's not uniform everywhere. It's clumpy. And locally, and by locally I mean, you know, us and maybe tens of galaxies, you know, a few hundred megaparsecs is local for a cosmologist. Locally, there's clumps that are falling together, and they form the structures that we see, the galaxies, the stars that make up the galaxies. And they are what I would call the imperfections that make life possible and make the universe interesting. Does that answer the question?
One thing that I think he asked me about three dimensions, why three dimensions? Well, we live in three dimensions. Now, some theories predict there are more than three dimensions out there. For example, superstring theories say that there are nine. So three, the usual north, south, east, west, up and down, plus six other ones that we clearly don't see, right? So the question becomes, okay, if these dimensions are real, where are they? And so what they say, and actually my PhD thesis was precisely on this, what happened to the extra dimensions? I didn't have that title, but it's precisely that idea. And some of the ideas that, well, you know, they start sort of together, but then the six dimensions stay small while the other three grow. So there is an isotropy, a breaking of symmetry, if you want, that actually keeps them, six of them together while three of the other ones grow. The question is why? What would do that? You know, what sort of effects would cause that? And there are all sorts of possibilities for that, none of them very compelling at the moment, because amongst other things, we don't really know if these extra dimensions are there or not. Even though it's a prediction of some theories that they exist, there's nothing at this point that we can point to say, yes, it's true, they do. But it's a very interesting idea.
Okay, let's move on.
As an economist, you know, if you're explaining something, quite often the explanation will change over time. People change, theories change. So you may have the same phenomenon you're looking at, but over 40 years, the theory changes. In what you're dealing with, is there any possibility of the actual data, the matter you are looking at, has some dynamic, some change over time? And would theories change in science?
Theories change all the time. That's progress. But you also talked about whether the data can change. And that also is a very interesting question. One of the things that I've spent some time looking at is actually testing whether the constants of nature are constant. By looking at distant galaxies, we can look at the strength of the pull between the proton and the electron, for example, was the same in the past or in the different environments that you get out there in space.
You're going to have to unpack that a bit, Tamara, because how can you look at a proton and an electron on a distant galaxy?
When you're looking at light, light comes in a whole bunch of different wavelengths, and different chemicals, different atoms, emit light when they're excited in different wavelengths. And each atom has a fingerprint. It can only emit some very specific wavelengths. Now, we can look at those wavelengths in a lab here on Earth that an iron atom emits, for example. And we can look at iron, which has this approximately the same fingerprint in distant galaxies, and we can measure how well that matches the fingerprint that we see here on Earth. The reason that it has a precise fingerprint is because of the strength of the coupling between the proton and the electron. So if there's a change, if we see that changed fingerprint, we see evidence for changing constants.
There's something very similar in the physics theories and the economics theories as well, which is they split into two parts. There's a mathematical formalism, and once that's been developed, that doesn't change. But there's the interpretation of the theory, and that can change greatly. So Maxwell, who came up with the first unified theory of electricity and magnetism, his formalism, well, the Maxwell-Heaviside formalism, hasn't changed to this day. But he originally thought about mechanistic cogs in an ether. It's a completely whack way of thinking about things. We teach it to our students in third year so they have a bit of a chuckle and move on. It's not at all the interpretation we use of exactly the same mathematical formalism today. Now we talk about electrical and magnetic waves co-propagating with one another in space. Maxwell wouldn't have understood that interpretation of the theory at all. So it's certainly true that interpretations of theories can change with time. The data that was used to develop that theory is exactly the same. It hasn't changed since the 1800s. If you grab a magnet, put some filings near it, they'll move on a bit of paper the same way they did for Maxwell. But what we now think is going on, the picture has completely changed.
A question from the floor.
What do you find more interesting, the symmetries or the asymmetries, when you look at theories? So we have two different perspectives on stage there.
Gloves on.
I find them both interesting. So I'm not going to give you the this is better than the other kind of answer. I think they're both important and they both tell you a part of the story. So you really need to look at both of them. So for example, in a very prosaic sense, if you want to look at a human face, you're going to see there are many, many symmetries immediately on the human face, but no human face is perfectly symmetric. So if you're going to describe a human face, you need both the symmetries that show up, but also the asymmetries, right? So I always talk about Marilyn Monroe. Actually, I have a chapter in my book which is called Marilyn Monroe's Mole, because she had that little beauty mark over here, right? And the question is, you know, would she be more or less beautiful with or without that beauty mark? So the asymmetries are always present, and I think you need both. But the point that I make in the book is, as Tamara already said, is that a lot of the structures that exist in nature, from galaxies, starting from matter, the fact that matter exists as opposed to just pure radiation in the universe comes from a very fundamental asymmetry that exists in the laws of nature, that there is more matter than the so-called antimatter, which is kind of an exotic but not really idea, that to every particle of matter, there should be a cousin of antimatter. So an electron, which is negative, would have a positron, which is a positive particle. You know, there is this sort of balance between the two things. And the problem is that the laws that predicted that they should be the same amounts of matter and antimatter can't be right, because if they were just the same, when matter and antimatter touch, they disintegrate into pure radiation. So a universe that would have as much matter as antimatter would be just filled with radiation. There'll be no matter, there'll be no life. So it wouldn't be here. So you have to look at those asymmetries when you describe the origin of structure, you know, from matter, then to galaxies. And of course, life itself is profoundly dependent on asymmetries. And I spent about a third of the book or more talking about the asymmetries on life itself. So, you know, you have to look at both sides of the same coin.
Andrew, any comment that you'd like to make there?
I'm in violent agreement.
Yeah. That makes great radio. Thank you very much.
Look, if you want to fight, you might want to move to the part of his book where he describes about likelihood of life elsewhere in the universe.
Oh, good.
Okay, then take it. Andrew. Well,
so Marcelloni's book has a lovely description of something called the Drake equation, which is an equation that lets you calculate the probability of life elsewhere in the universe. It has something like 10 variables.
Depends which version of it you're looking at.
Right. A couple of handfuls of variables, not one of which we know. So if you take a whole lot of things we don't know and multiply them together, you get a number that varies anywhere between one and a big number. So this is great. This is the kind of thing you talk about at a conference. After the hard work's done for the day, you're having a nice relaxing coffee or beer at the bar, because you're utterly unconstrained by data. And so I think it really comes down to whether you're a pessimist or an optimist. And reading Marcelo's book, I think you're a bit pessimistic, which is very unusual for a Brazilian. They're normally very optimistic.
Well, right. So basically the notion is the following, that depending who you talk to, when we talk about life in the universe, you have to make an immediate distinction, okay? You have to talk about what kind of life. You can talk about unicellular simple life, right? And you can talk about complex multicellular and in particular intelligent life. And you have to make this distinction because the jump from unicellular life to complex multicellular life is amazingly difficult, and it goes through many, many steps as far as we can tell. And intelligence is even farther out there. There's no reason why life existing somewhere, even if it's multicellular life, would lead to intelligence. I give you an example. You know, the dinosaurs existed here on Earth for over 150 million years. They were quite stupid, and they survived quite well. They did not need to be intelligent to be here, even though they were multicellular life. So when people talk about the Drake equation was really something that spearheaded the so-called Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence project, which is trying to find out other intelligent beings in the universe. And parts of that equation were like, how many stars are there that can have planets? How many planets can have the basic distance from the sun like we have so that water can be liquid? Of those planets, how many of them can have life? Of those, how many of them can have complex life, intelligent life that has a civilization? In civilizations that have radio technology. So each one is a term that we have no clue about. But the usefulness, I guess, is that it kind of makes you think about all the many different steps that you need in order to get from, you know, an amoeba to somebody that has a radio antenna. What I say in my book, I look at the history very carefully. I look at the history of life on Earth. How did it happen here? What we know of it? The Earth is about 4.5 billion years. Life appeared at about 3.5 billion years ago, maybe 3.7 or 8, depending who you talk to. There's a bit of controversy, which is fairly fast. And it stayed unicellular for about 2.5 billion years. And only at 500 to 800 million years ago, they start having multicellularity. And so I go through this argument, and I find that, yes, there are other planets out there. For sure, they're going to look like Earth. No question about it. In fact, the Kepler mission from NASA found one, which was 1.5 times the Earth mass, which is a fabulous result. And I have no doubt there'll be some kind of life out there. But my bet is that most of the life that is out there is going to be simple. It's not going to be complex, multicellular, and much less intelligent. But I don't rule it out. Again, I'm very careful to say that if there is life out there, it could be intelligent, but it's certainly very far away. So the point I make is just that intelligent, complex life is very rare. And because of that, we are very important. We here on planet Earth are very special after all. You know, Copernicus wasn't so right. I think humans are incredibly relevant because we are the only species that we know of that actually are conscious of our existence and that can do something to protect the planet that we have that, as we know, is extremely rare and difficult to reproduce out there. So that's really the crux of my argument.
So I don't disagree with the second point. I like to think we're important too. And certainly we need to kind of pull the finger out re-global climate change and things like that. But the point where I disagree is where you say life's very rare. You've just got no data for that. We don't know.
Complex life is
complex. Okay, but right. But you just don't know. Say it's one part in 10 to the 10 probability. That's 0.10 zeros in a row, one. Mm. Well, there's something like 10 to the 17 stars in the universe. So that means complex life exists in 10 million places. That's pretty common. But it may not be terribly close.
Marcelo, one of the things I like about reviewing science books or books about science is that almost all of them, I can think of one or two very rare exceptions that were not written for the money. They were written because they want to advance science and they want to advance human thinking. So what sort of advances can you see arising out of the publication of your book? Do you think that people are going to start rethinking the idea of asymmetry and unified theories?
Okay, so let's think about it. Some of the books are really just to popularize the main ideas of science because they're just beautiful and they're cutting edge, you know, and they're essentially, in a very, very large way, defining the way we live our lives, you know. So it's important to do that. So this book, yes, it is trying to be a little bit ambitious in the sense that it's trying to say things that perhaps other people think, but they haven't really been saying very much of it. And I think that physics, you know, in this pursuit of perfection is being a little bit old-fashioned. And I actually, at some point, I make a parallel with art. You know, I look at how art in the 20th century broke up with this notion of perfection, you know, that actually it was the extra imperfect stroke that made the paint beautiful, or it was the dissonance in music that made it even more appealing. And I think that nature is also dissonant and also has these extra brushes out there that make it imperfect and because of that, creative. So I am proposing a little bit of a change of focus in a sense, at least to those physicists that are working way out there, you know, in a different sphere than Andrew is in a sense. But still, this whole approach to nature as thinking that perfection is beautiful is, I think, passé, you know, is really not what's going on. So I am proposing a change of focus that I think will be beneficial.
Andrew, you were about to say?
Well, it's interesting that you said it's an old-fashioned approach. An interesting sociological thing about string theory and the people doing it is most of them are over 40. There's a generation of physicists coming through who just aren't really doing it very much now compared to a whole bunch of the other interesting physics there is to do. So like all science, there's, I guess, there's fashions, things come and go. And I guess I told you earlier to be patient, but a lot of people, of course, don't want to wait 40 or 50 years for the data, and so they go off to do other interesting things with their time as well.
Good.
Tamara, you have a teaching position here at the University of Queensland. Has Marcello's book changed the way that you might teach aspects of your course? Has it made you rethink some of the basic ways you go about your science?
I actually agree very much with most of what is said in the book. And I think we come from different societies. I come a bit more from the observational, experimental things where we have less of an obsession with finding the perfect answers. So I always actually thought it strange that when you're looking at a grand unified theory, people actually expected to get the constants of nature right through this theory. I'm much more comfortable with those constants being a result of chance that just happened to be the universe that we ended up living in. So that part of failure of unification I'm quite comfortable with, and I think that is not a failure at all, that even if we can explain the grand framework underlying how that physics works, even if we can't explain every single tiny little detail that might be contingent, I think that's actually a success and something that's still worth aiming for.
Andrew?
Well, I really enjoyed the book. But one of the things I thought is that this belief that you can have a theory of everything, which I've always found to be a very kind of arrogant name, this is kind of a sin of theoretical physicists. And as we all know, reformed sinners make the best preacher. And I think of Marcello as a reformed sinner here, that he says in the book, you know, I realized one day this was not the approach to take. And since that kind of accords a little more with, I think, Tamara's and my worldview, it's a very enjoyable book.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a very enjoyable afternoon's discussion, hasn't it? We've gone from the beginning of time and the universe. We've gone to the very edges of what we know, and I think we've learned a lot. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for our three panellists today. Marcello Gleiser, Tamara Davis, and Andrew White.
Thanks to our host, ABC TV's Paul Willis, and to the producer of that Cafe Scientific event at last year's Brisbane Writers' Festival, Abby Thomas. Panellists were Andrew White and Tamara Davis, both from the University of Queensland, and Marcello Gleiser, Professor of Natural Philosophy, Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth University in the US. He's also the author of the book Imperfect Creation, The Gloriously Messy Universe. Visit the Big Ideas website at abc.net.au/rn, where you'll find information and downloadable audio of all our programs. Thanks to sound engineer Lila Schunner. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Next week in our Big Ideas Summer of Science series, a debate to mark 2010 as the year of biodiversity. Is the planet better off without us? It's a close competition, so don't miss it. Bye for now.